Hey, everybody, welcome back to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. This is episode 208. As you know, we are a Paul McCartney show mainly dealing with the solo career of Paul McCartney, but we're going to do a little something a little different this week, and it should be pretty interesting. As you can see, we have a guest, but first, I'm Tom Hunyadi. You may know me from my other show, Talk More Talkies, Solo Beatles video cast. And as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, my backwards traveler. He is Andy Nichols. Andy, my friend, what's going on?
Good, Tom. Good to hear. Good to see you. Nice hat. And very nice. I haven't seen that one on you before. And really happy
to picked it up.
Oh, you did? It's a new one? Yeah. Happy to have an honorary Scouser on the show today.
Yes, yes. Many of you know her from her John Lennon series. She's got 5 books out right now, titled Should Have Been There, Shivering Inside, She Loves You, Should Have Known Better, and Shades of Life, Part 1. She is Jude Sutherland Kessler. Jude, really happy to have you here. How you doing?
I am so glad to be here. Thank you, guys. What an honor to be on a Paul McCartney podcast. I thought I was going to be episode 207 because I just listened to 206. I'm like, that's 9.
Oh, yeah. That would have worked out well, wouldn't it?
Number nine. Thank you very, very much. Always enjoy seeing you guys at the fest. And I just really excited to be on the show. Thank you.
You've got it. I mean, you're like you said, you know, you're at the fest. You have your show, She Said, She Said. We'll talk about that as well. But we're here to talk about John and Paul's 21st birthdays, each as they happened. And but first, we're going to talk about your books. And one thing you notice right off the bat is on the cover, it says a novel of the life. I mean, talk about your approach and why are you going? I mean, because it doesn't say. I'm sure people would thought that this would be a biography, but it says a novel. So talk about that approach and it being a novel rather than a biography.
Well, and when did you get the itch to start to write these books? Yeah.
Okay. I knew from the time that I was a little girl that I wanted to write a biography about someone, but write it as a narrative so that people could read it as a story. So when I went to college, I got 2 degrees in 3 years, 1 degree in history, historical research, historiography, and another degree in English. Went on and got my master's in English and started thinking about who do I want to write this book about. I wanted it to be sort of like the Irving Stone biographies or Michener's biography, for example, Origin, that he wrote about Charles Darwin, where you're getting exactly what they did, all of the research. For example, when Irving Stone wrote The Life of Michelangelo, he moved to Italy for 12 years and lived there doing the research on Michelangelo. You immerse yourself in telling the story of that person, but you tell it as a narrative. Well, I gave it to my uncle, Charles Pierce Rowland, who wrote 20 some odd books on the Civil War to read. And I said, what do you think about this? He said, I think this is going to cause you a lot of problems. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, people are not going to think it's truthful. They're going to think it's made up. It's like historical fiction. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, but I'm making sure that everything is exactly as it happened. And he said, I'm not sure that you won't have problems with this. So I went ahead. It was my dream. This is what I wanted to do. So I plugged ahead. When the first book, Should Have Been There, came out, I heard for the very first time the term fan fiction. Didn't even know fan fiction existed. And what I did in book number one is at the back of the book, I took every chapter and gave you all of the sources that chapter entailed. For example, the chapter that I wrote on the topic that we're going to discuss today, which was Paul and John's trip to Paris for John's 21st birthday, I used Bill Harry's Ultimate Beatles Encyclopedia, Pete Best's book with Doncaster Beatle, Mark Lewison's Beatles Chronicle, Hunter Davies' first book on the Beatles. I had a whole list of sources, but I didn't footnote each sentence. So people are like, how does she know that? How is that true? We don't know if this is factual or not. Well, so by the time that I got to the second book, Shivering Inside, I started footnoting. I had about 400 or 500 footnotes in that book. Then people still were like, why do you know this one thing right here? So now I footnote almost every sentence, and I give you every source that said that. So the last book had 4,400 and some odd footnotes. So you were getting exactly what they ate, what they said, what they wore. John wearing the same thing sometimes 4 or 5 days in a row. I think that was a Mimi thing. Everything. And I get into the weeds. Like, for example, when they were in Canada in 1964, I talked to the guy that delivered their food, and he said that they had like what we would call chicken fingers today, or chicken tenders, and chips or fries. Then there was another guy, the promoter for the show, who said, no, that's not what they had at all. They had hamburgers and fries. So, I mean, I like get into so much depth to try to figure out exactly what happened, and then present it as if you're there and you're witnessing what's going on. But it is the slowest writing you can imagine, because for every sentence, I have to stop, drop in the notation, go to the notation, put in Davies, page 158, Harry, page. It is a slow.
So you wanted to use legitimate sources to back up your writing with those to prove it, to illustrate what the narrative you're trying to tell.
Right. And at the end of every chapter, I would say, let's take Paul's birthday, Paul's 21st birthday. Okay. So I have a segment where I say, where did the party take place? And I give you everything that everybody says, because some people say Auntie Jen's in Huskinson Street. Some people say Annie Jen's in Dennis Lane. Some people spell it G-I-N. Mm. Some people spell it J-E-N. Some people's, I mean, I give you every person.
So you're kind of getting into linguistics and geography and stuff. And that kind of leads us into, before we get into the birthday parties, talk about your experiences in Liverpool and your time there. As somebody who spent a lot of time there as well, I'm really curious to hear about your journey there, how much time you spent there when you were writing these books.
Okay, I went researching every year for 7 years straight. And we started out going a week, and then we'd stretch it out a little bit. And we tried to do three.
Well, let's start with the year. What year? I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt. What year did you start going?
1993 through 2000. Okay. And we would try to do three interviews a day. So we would do one in the morning, one in the afternoon, one at night. It'd be funny because a lot of them we did in the grapes. And when we come back to do the night interview, the same people would be there that were there. And you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
It's like, how can they still be here? You know, I mean, oh my gosh.
It's pub culture, man. It's a way of life.
I would try to wear something that I thought would be, you know, cute. And oh my gosh, there's no way you can outdress the girls over there.
On a Saturday night when the wags come out?
Wow.
Yeah, it's like Halloween.
They got to be freezing because their stomachs are cut out.
Oh, I'm telling you.
I'm like, it's like 30 degrees with the wind blowing off the Mersey, and that's what you're wearing?
Yep.
And there's no way. No way. But anyway, we talked to so many people. I could not have written this book without them. For example, Bill Harry, I gave him his chapter and he goes, oh, like you got a bunch of stuff wrong. I said, okay, well, that's why I'm giving it to you. What do I have wrong? And he said, you have me sitting in the front room of the grapes. I never did that. I mean, you cracked. I sat in the back room, put me under the painting of Lord Nelson, and you got me drinking ale. I only drink bitter. I'm like, okay, well, thank you. June Furlong, I don't know if you knew, she was a life model at Liverpool College of Art, and she was bigger than life. I mean, she was such a personality. She's like, oh, no, 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 no. You've got a tendril hanging down on the wrong side. I only had it on the left side. And then she, you know, she would tell me all about John and the time that he came and asked her to borrow clothes for his Cinderella farce that he was putting on at the art college, and what the earrings were that she let him borrow, her grandmother's, and what the dresses were that she let him borrow, and what happened when one of the players in the Cinderella farce girlfriend showed up and said, screamed at him from the audience, "You've been cheating on me." And he jumped off the stage after her. And I mean, these were stories I could never know if I hadn't talked to these people. Never.
Right. And you know? And it makes total sense why you had to immerse yourself in the culture.
Yeah.
To write a story, to learn all these people, to learn all these stories, because as a Yank here, you're not going to get that do the story justice.
You've got to be really judicious, because Eddie Porter told me that there was an episode at the Odd Spot Club where Paul was leaning against the bar and he had his toe down so that the bottom, there's Eddie, right there, had the bottom of Paul's shoe was showing, and there was a price tag on it, and someone made fun of him and he took a swing at him, which we know that's not Paul. Paul would never take a swing at anyone for kidding him about the price tag on his shoe. And they got into a fight and a young American stepped in to stop the fight. And that young American was Bill Clinton. No, I don't believe that.
I did not break up that fight.
Depends on what your definition of fight is. But no, you have to really be careful, because everybody wants to be in the story and everybody wants to expand the story. But I mean, I talked to, oh my gosh, so many people. Helen Anderson.
Yep.
And John.
Cynthia's. Smith, yeah. Yep.
Tony Carricker and Jeff Muhammad and that whole group. She was in with that group. I got to talk with Rod Murray. Sad story, because, you know, he's making a guitar to be in the band. He's constructing a guitar when Stu gets pulled into the band and he doesn't. But he, you know, he had some great stories to tell about Gambier Terrace. Talked with Alan many times, Alan Williams, with Bob Wooler. Bob gave me a test. We like I said, we met at a seafood restaurant on Lark Lane, and he said, "Before I give you an interview, I'm going to ask you 10 questions, and you should be able to answer all of these." And so he started quizzing me before he would give me an interview. It just, everybody, our friend Joe Flannery,
yep,
took my husband and I to the Sudley Art Gallery, kind of watched to see if we had any class or we had any the je ne sais quoi that would allow him to give us an interview. Thankfully, we did, and got a great interview with him. Sam, his brother Sam Flannery, both of them were instrumental in helping Pete after the break from the
Beatles.
Talked to Pete. It just so many people. I could not have written these books because, listen, Andy, I didn't know where the Empire Theater was in relation to Matthew Street, which way you would go. You know,
because when you first go there, you just think Liverpool, right? And then you get there and you learn the terrain and you're like, whoa, this is a really, really big city. And it's really, it's huge.
Right. And the first year I went, I had on my little, like a writer outfit, like a jacket and a skirt and, you know, all that. The next year I went back in leathers with leather boots and, you know, and people were asking me directions. They're like, "Where is such and such?" You know, I also learned to say, "I don't know what you just said," because
you're right.
Because you can't understand a lot of it. And no. I didn't want to appear stupid the first year, so I missed a lot.
How many times when they said to you, "Are you all right?" You were like, "Yes, I'm all right." You didn't understand that was right. Just them saying hello.
Right. Well, the main one was the lady at the restaurant came up and said, "Well, cooked." I'm like, "What? Well, cooked? What?" Finally, I figured out she was asking me if I want the cooked breakfast.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was so embarrassed to say, "I don't know what you're saying," the first year. And of course, by the seventh year, I understood. But it took me a long time. And then I was trying and tying everyone. But yeah.
So you went over the course of 7 years. Was it like over the summer? Like, did you go for a month at a time? How did you do it?
No, we would, at first we went for just a week, and then we'd go like for 9 days. Listen, my husband loves America so much, and he was in such withdrawal by the time that we got to, you know, the almost 2 week period, that he's like, "Oh, please, I've got to go home." I went into the bathroom the first year that we were there, and I wasn't coming out. I wasn't getting on the flight, and he sent someone in there after me, like, "Go get my wife. She's intentionally trying to miss his flight and stay in Liverpool."
Understandable.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Jude, let me ask you, while you're there these 7 years, you're researching John's whole life, right? You're not just, you know, you're just doing bits and pieces here and there. You're actually talking to people throughout John's career. So then that way, when you get to say book, you know, 7 or 8, you've already got, you know, research done for that.
Yeah. And I'm still doing that now because I mean, a lot of the people we won't have by the time that I get to the later books.
Yes.
Right. And I'm doing as many interviews as I can. I'm already missing, like I'm trying to find Ron Reynolds, who was the guy that introduced the Beatles in 1965 in Chicago for those two riotous.
Those shows. Yeah.
Gosh, those two shows were so dangerous, beyond dangerous. And I know that he's still alive, but I can't find him. And it's really difficult to sleuth people down after a while. So yeah, I did as many as I could. That's why we were doing 3 a day. And we were driving around in between and taking photographs of everything from the Old Dutch. The Old Dutch was still there. This is before the Year of Culture in Liverpool.
2008.
All cool stuff was still there. It was all still original. So everything on Renshaw and Ronnelly and, you know, the Jacaranda, the first year, the Jacaranda was horrible. Some people had moved in and they wouldn't move out and they had defiled it. And it was disgusting. And by about year 3 or 4, they renovated it. They uncovered the painting and you could go into the basement.
Oh, and see how it was restored. Yeah.
Yeah.
Before one more thing, photo I want to show you, since I'm about taking photos, before we dive into the 21st birthdays, is at the end, I want to see if you agree with the statement. I know you've heard this because you've been over there. Many Scousers feel that the Beatles really began to be a band at this show here at this venue. You know the one I'm talking about, yep. Litherland Town Hall, December 27, 1960. Do you agree with that statement?
Absolutely. There's my poster right behind me. This is the Beatles appearing at Litherland Town Hall with the Searchers, the Delrinas, the Deltones, and no doubt about it. That night, they've come back from Hamburg. They've only been back a short time. They're wearing their leathers. Most of the people in the audience think they're a German band.
Yep.
They are on... tethered.
Every Liverpool person that I met, interviewed, researched, said that's the day that the Beatles actually began to be
that's
the Beatles.
Why that's
that day.
Yeah, and Chas Newby, of course, that night is playing bass. Stu has stayed in Hamburg. Chas is playing bass. And he, Mark Lewison saw this poster when I did some presentation, and he emailed me and said, Jude, hey, listen, don't think that poster's real. It's not. And I said, I know. But on it, it says, from Chas Newby, I was there. It really happened. He goes, Chas Newby is as real as it gets. So
yeah, it's just, it's incredible when you learn about all these things, Tom.
Yeah. I got one thing, too, before we get to the main topic. And that's, you know, I'm just now getting your book. So apologies for that, you know, and I'm, you know, I haven't gotten into them yet. And I really can't wait to start digging into them. But I have to ask. You know, listen, you know, John's had some controversies throughout his life, okay? And I'm just curious on how, plus over the last 10 years, we know how people have been talking, you know, John was this, he was that, you know, and that's all they talk about, right? Okay, he was a bad father, he was a bad husband, okay? But they don't go that extra mile and do the other research. You know, they don't know that John talks about that and how forgiving he is and how much he wanted to be a better person. What do you say to those people that, you know, only look at the bad and don't realize that they're just human beings like us? They put their pants on one leg at a time like we do. And how do you handle that going forward? Especially, you know, when we get into, you know, into the 70s, too, when, you know, like the Lost Weekend, let's say. I mean, how do you attend to cover that? And what do you say to those people that just look at the bad and not the whole picture?
Well, I say the same thing to them that I said to the people in the early 80s who tried to deify John. You know, right after he died, he was like pictured in the white suit, almost with a halo, definitely a dove on his shoulder. You know, he was so wonderful. He was so perfect. They were wrong. And the people that say he was a bad father, because John says It's not loving that I know most about because I was never loved. He tells you that. It's not knowing how to have a relationship that I know most about because no one ever had a relationship with me. I say, this is a man. This is a man who has great days, who befriends Helen Shapiro when she's just 16 years old on the Helen Shapiro tour and carries her luggage and takes care of her and makes sure that she gets food and she's taken care of. This is a man who would come and see the girls standing in line in Matthew Street or Matthew Street, as Bob Wooler used to call it, out in the cold. And he only had a little bit of money, but he would give his bus fare to get them food, as many as he could. You know, this is a person that Helen Anderson will tell you was so hurt at Liverpool College of Art. He had lost his mother a second time to death. When he was 4.5 years old, he'd been shunted off to Mimi's house to live because Pop Stanley thought that was the right thing for this little boy. He shouldn't live with his mother because his mother was living in sin. So he goes to Mimi's house to live. He finds out his mother has two children, has two little girls. So it's not children she doesn't want. It's me she doesn't want. She doesn't love me. And he grows up thinking that why would my mom send me away? Why would my dad disappear and never get in touch with me again? Not knowing that Fred was writing to him all the time, but Mimi was throwing the letters away. No one loves me. What's wrong with me? No one, I think, is.
And Freddie wanted to take him to New Zealand to sell stockings or whatever.
The black market trade. Absolutely. His dad loved him. And his mother loved him. She used to put on this record called My Son John and sit there and cry. They both loved him. But they did in the 1950s what was, you know, supposed to be right, or it was actually 1946, give the little boy security. His Mimi will take him to school. She'll take him to Sunday school. He'll do chores. This is what the family decided was best for that little boy. And he grew up thinking no one cared about him. Then when he does get to be close to his mom in his teenage years, after Uncle George, the only person that ever showed him any love, dies, and they send that little boy away. They don't let him even be there when Uncle George dies. He's in Scotland at Mater's house, the same one that gives him money for this trip that we're going to talk about. When he comes home, they've had the funeral. George is gone.
He's the only male figure that had of any importance in his life. Yeah.
And he starts laughing and can't stop. And this goes on for hours. And they finally call Julia in and say, you got to do something. He's gone nuts. And she says, I'm going to be George. I can't be a mother. You have one. I'm going to be Uncle George. And they start spending every day together. They're like so close. And then she's killed. And then this broken person invests what's left of his heart in Stu Sutcliffe, his soulmate. He and Stu write, when Stu stays in Hamburg, they're writing each other 21-page letters almost every day. They are closer than brothers. This is the only person that he feels really loves him, because with Cynthia, he's tentative. She adores him, but he even writes, if I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true? You know, because look, I've been left before. I've been abandoned before. And I'm scared. I'm so scared. He asked Cynthia all the time, are you going to leave me? Are you going to leave me?
It's a lot. And I heard your appearance on the other podcast talking about I Call Your Name, because that ties into the same exact emotion.
Scared to death. So, you know, then he attaches himself to Stu. Stu accepts him no matter what. And then Stu dies of a cerebral hemorrhage. I mean, if anybody has a right to be in a bad mood, most people would crack up over that kind of stuff. Most people, and there was no treatment for depression. There was no medicine that you took. There was no counseling, you know, rub some dirt on it, walk it off kind of thing, you know? So I say to those people, you can't judge someone till you walk a mile in their shoes. How would you do if your parents abandoned you? You grew up with an aunt who was the essence of decorum and duty. She did do good things. She taught him responsibility and determination and stick-to-itiveness. She did do good things. But every day that little boy would say, "Why are you here for me after school, Auntie Mimi?" And every day she would say, "It is my duty to do so." I mean, come on, the kid wants you to say, "Because I love you." I mean, just once, could you say that? I mean, he had a really tough road, and yet he turned it all into the soundtrack of our lives. "Help, Nowhere Man. I'm a loser and I'm not what I appear to be. Tell me why you cried and why you lied to me. Why did you leave me? You said you weren't going to. I said to you, if I go in the backyard and play with my dog, you're not going to leave me, are you?" And she left him.
Right. "Don't you know I can't take it? I don't know I can. I'm not going to make it." Yeah.
"I'm not that kind of man." I mean, he did the best he could. He did the best he could. He wrote music. He poured his biography into those songs. He formed the band because his mother said he had music in his bones and that would save him. And he kept trying to find something that would heal his broken heart. "My band will heal my broken heart. Getting a number one will heal my broken heart. Drugs will heal my broken heart. LSD will heal it. Getting a new wife,
right.
Moving to another country." Somebody help, help. That's what he's saying. I think he did the best he could. You know?
And he met somebody that, you know, was maybe almost nearly a soulmate, not like quite Stu, but with right. Paul.
Yeah. 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 And then, you know, the Lost Weekend, everybody only talks about the bad part of the Lost Weekend. The right. Lost Weekend is 18 months. May Pang reunites him with Cynthia and with Julian. She heals those wounds. He begins to write again under her love and care, and he puts out Walls and Bridges. It's a very positive time if you concentrate only on the Tommy Smothers incident and the right. Nilsson Schmilsson. You know, I mean, come on, there was more to it than that. John was good, John was bad, John was a human being. And I think for the what he had to endure growing up, he did okay.
All right, we'll move on because I'm going to start crying here in a second.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But
it's true, but everything you said, Jude, emotional. Rings 100% true. And the passion that you've put into your work, the time you've spent researching, the people you've interviewed, the people you've met, the sacrifices you've met, it's so evident in your books and in your delivery and everything you've done. So it's refreshing to see an American take an approach like that, to dive in and do all that work to right. show all the aspects of somebody who we all love, which is awesome.
Thank you very much. My husband and I have been very blessed that we've been able to have children live with us through the years who were in bad situations, some for 9 months, some for 6 months, some for a long time. And John is the one who's lived with us the longest. So.
Absolutely.
All right. Very good. Well, we'll talk more about the books and how people can get them a little later on in the show. But one thing, right, let's talk about John's 21st birthday. And right off the bat, as I'm reading your book and researching other books, I've seen two different amounts given to him by his Aunt Elizabeth. I saw 40 pounds, which you write, and then in Mark's book, he's got 100 pounds.
Yeah. And
which is it?
I did a lot of research on this. So let me tell you what I think, and I could be totally wrong. I mean, we know we all try to do our best. We try to research, we try to dig, but I could be totally wrong. But I wrote that long before the anthology came out, and Bill Harry is the source. And Bill, John, and Paul all planned this trip together. And Bill furthermore says, and this is a direct quote from him, and I'll get right back to the money. "Some reports have suggested that John and Paul left without informing George and Pete, who were disgusted by the action, which almost caused the group to break up and resulted in Ray McFaul and Bob Wooler lecturing John and Paul about acting responsibly. This is not true. John and Paul had planned this trip and no bookings were made for the period that they were away." Okay. And that is backed up by Mark Lewison as well. But Bill says that he got 40 pounds. So I looked up to see how much 40 pounds would be in 1961 and how much 100 pounds would be in 1961. All right. So 40 pounds is equivalent to about $1,000, a little bit less than $1,000. Wow. But 100 pounds, according to USDollars.com, turns out to be about $20,000. I don't think his aunt gave him $20,000 because this is what Cynthia says. They eked out the little bit of money that they had for a 2-week trip. Paul says they stayed in kind of a dingy hotel right. with only one mm-hmm. bed. Bill Harry says they stayed in a hostel in Montmartre, but their money ran out. Well, if you've got $20,000 for 2 weeks, there's no way $2,000.
$2,000. Okay.
They've got $2,847.94 if they get 100 pounds.
In 1961, yeah. So
I looked up in 1961, you could go to the Conrad Hilton and get a baked ham sandwich for a dollar. You could get 3 cans of Planters peanuts for a dollar. Right. I mean, come on. There's no way they had $3,000. There's no way.
Plus, they had to pay to get there as well. I mean, right? I mean, they did take a... you know, a ferry or a train, right? Yeah. And then the ferry to Dunkirk. But then let me ask you this. There's also no truth to Sin and Dot not knowing that they were going as well, right? I mean, they knew that this was going to happen as well.
Yeah, they planned the whole thing out. They had this whole, I'm sure you read about Paul's the bowler hat scheme.
But yes, the bowler
hat. They decided that they're going to hitchhike. And Paul says, well, I saw these guys that were wrapped in Union Jacks and they were getting rides from everyone. So we got to get a gimmick. So they get these bowler hats, which is hilarious because they're wearing their leather jackets and they're wearing their drain pipe jeans and then bowler hats, which must have looked ridiculous. But he said that every time that girls drove by, he could see girls coming. They whip those bowler hats off and be standing as tough as they could. But if it was a truck driver or lorry driver, they put the bowler hats
right.
Okay, well, Paul says that we had no luck, and so we just took the train. John says we got sick of doing it. We were lazy. So it's somewhere in between.
In the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the middle. As a lot of things end up being. So why do you think John came to the conclusion to only invite Paul? I mean, obviously, they're a partnership. They're in the band together. But, you know... Why just Paul?
Well, you know, later, like if you fast forward 2 years, George and John go on holiday together, like constantly. They are at, and go to Ireland for that Easter weekend. Then they go on that trek to Tahiti that they're on a supposed yacht, which is really more like a fishing boat. That thing was nasty. And all they had to eat for the whole week was potatoes. I mean, it was not a good trip. But he goes with George. This time he's going with Paul. So one of the things, as you know, that most embarrassed John about George was that he was so much younger. And when you're just turning 21 and he's 3 years younger, that's a big difference. When you're 25 or 26 and he's 3 years younger, it's a little bit better. But I think he still considered George to be a kid who followed him around everywhere he went. In fact, when Cynthia has appendicitis and John goes to the hospital to see her, George goes with him. He followed him everywhere he went. Cynthia starts crying when they walk into the room because she's all dolled up in their hospital attire and she can't wait to see John, and George walks in and she's like, ah! But I think that at that point, he and Paul were more age compatible, friend compatible. As the years go along, he begins to drift more toward George. But at this point, they were big buddies.
How much stock do you put into them having the because they both lost their mothers? Do you think that was a big bond, or is that overstated?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that in the back of their minds it is. But there's a quote that says the same hot water that hard boils the egg softens the carrot. And that's really what happened here, because it made Paul's heart very caring and open and genial. And he's that soft carrot because it made him into a more empathetic person. It absolutely made John into a hard-boiled egg.
Yep.
Because he's lost her sure. time.
Yeah. You know? And I'm sure Paul is excited about this too, because I mean, there was that competition between him and Stu, you know, to get, you know, John's attention, even though you know, it was John and Stu were best friends at the time. Here's Paul wanting that acceptance. He wanting that friendship because that, in a way they were the leaders of the band.
Right.
You know, and they figured, and you know, so it's kind of curious to think that, you know, maybe this was a more of a bonding trip together to, you know, are we going to continue with the band? I mean, how are we going to, you know, continue? I mean, do we need to, you know, focus on ourselves first? I mean, it's really interesting, you know, when you think about the fact that it was just those two that went.
Yeah. And they had so much fun together. Paul talks about them sitting in these open air cafes and drinking wine. And Paul had a cape, a gendarme's cape on, right. And John rolled his pants down real low. And Paul says, let's see if I can find it. He says something really funny. He goes, "Hey, here we are, two artsy guys in a cafe. This is us in Paris. Can't you see them with that?"
Yeah.
They had a great time together.
Right. So they meet Jürgen Vollmer. That's how you pronounce his name?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they meet Jürgen there. Was Stu ever supposed to go? Or was it?
Oh, yeah. Stu was supposed to be there. He's supposed to meet John there. There's a letter between the two of them. I believe it's in Stuart Sutcliffe, the book that Pauline worked on. And he was going to come. But by now, Stu is having massive headaches all the time. So bad that he's blacking out from them. He's lost weight. He's really thin. He's dying, but no one knows this. I mean, they've taken him to doctor after doctor after doctor. And as Jürgen says, they tortured him almost like he's, you know, in a concentration camp because they can't figure out what's wrong with him. And they don't have what we have today to figure out that he had a massive brain hemorrhage. And so he doesn't show up and it breaks John's heart. That's really why he went, right. Because he thought that maybe Stu could get there.
And then your book, you have something quite unique is you write a possible conversation between John and Jürgen about Stu. Talk about that and how you came to write that conversation.
All the documentation in Pauline's book about what was happening with Stu, what doctor he'd been to, what tests they'd run on him, what the diagnosis was, what his symptoms were, what the prognosis was moving ahead. And you know that John is going to ask Jürgen because that's all he really cares about. I mean, you know, that's why he's there. He thought he was going to be with Stu. And so he's asking him, and all of Jürgen's answers are what's in Pauline's book. Exactly. This is what's happening.
See, and that's just another loss that hardened him.
Yeah. Really hardened
him. Really hardened him. You know?
It was as close, because when he found out about Stu dying, they get there one day too late.
Yep.
One day too late. And when she's waiting without Stu at the airport and he sees her, he does the same thing he did with Uncle George. He just went hysterical. And he wasn't right for 2 months after that. That's all of these things that you see of him on stage with the toilet seat around his head. And he's doing horrible stuff. And I mean, it was a huge loss. So that conversation is straight out of Pauline's book. I think it's called Stuart Sutcliffe, The Lost Beatle, where she's telling you why he did not go to Paris. And so the answers that Jürgen's giving is exactly what's in her book.
Okay, interesting. This is also a very, very interesting time in Paris history. I mean, it's very unstable time. They're seeing a lot, you know, not necessarily witnessing, but stuff going on. I mean, one is, you know, a bomb wrecked a foyer. You got a Ray Charles show that was postponed. From a Muslim protest, you've got, you know, 40 protesters were killed while protesting. Really, you know, and the French have always been, you know, very passionate about their beliefs and protesting whenever they think feel it's necessary.
Yeah. You
know? So a very interesting time to be in Paris.
And yet they have such a good time. You know, they go to the flea markets. They're looking for what later becomes one of Paul's trademarks, that sleeveless sweater vest. That's what they're looking for, is a sleeveless sweater vest. They go to see Billy Halliday. I mean, Johnny Halliday. I have a picture. This is a record by him. Mm-hmm. And you can see it spelled with a H-A. Is that too much glare? Can you
No, we can see it.
H-A-L-L-Y, I think that they spell it with an I in the letter that Paul writes to Bill Harry. And then here's the back of it. So they go to see him perform. And have you seen the letter that Paul wrote to Bill Harry about this?
I'm sure I've seen it in the past, yeah.
It's so funny. I'll read you just a little tiny bit of it. This is Paul writing. He says, "It was 10 o'clock, it was, when we were entering the Olympia in Paris," which, of course, they're going to be going back to the Olympia in Paris at one point, "to see the Johnny Halliday rock show. The cheapest seats in Le Theatre," that's French, "were 7 and 6 pence. So we followed the woman with the torch," that's English. "When Johnny Halliday came, everybody went wild, and loud was the cheering and many the dancing in the aisles. But the man said, 'Sit down.' So we had to." And he goes on and on. He tells all about that. And then he goes into Le Rock Festival that they went to in Montmartre with Danny and the Pirates and many more groups for your evening's entertainment. Topping the bill was Vince, Ron, my boy, Ron Taylor of English Scream and the Two Eyes Coffee Bar." And it goes on and on. He tells all about what they did. You can just see, thank God they had breaks like this early on. Because once they get into 63, 64, 65.
Nonstop.
They have no breath.
No, the Two Eyes, baby. Yeah.
Two Eyes changed history.
Yeah.
The Two Eyes. If I had to say, if someone said, "What is the one thing that happened to the Beatles that made them into the Beatles?" It's the Two Eyes.
Yeah.
There's no doubt.
Right. This trip also turned into a big fashion change
for
them as well. I mean, what they discover the ankle high boots there in Paris. You know, they changed there. I mean, when they arrive, they're in the leather and their leather Elvis look. And then, you know, they completely just transform into different human beings, I guess, fashion in a fashion sense.
Yeah, I was so shocked to find that the Pilsenkopf that Jürgen cuts for them is not what they wanted. Paul says real specifically, "We wanted the cut that Jürgen had, which was a long Hitler swooped. It looked like Hitler's cut, swooped to the side." And John says he butchered their hair. He says cut or butchered our hair, hacked it, would be a better word. They wanted it to be that kind of swoop over, and it turned out to be too rounded for what they wanted. And Paul says, "We very nearly changed it back, but it wouldn't go. It kept flapping forward, and we gave up, and it caught on. But it wasn't what they wanted. They wanted a completely different look." Well, one of the legends, there's so many myths. I just, every day I run across something that's been repeated and repeated and repeated, and it's not true. And one is that they got this look originally from the Jean Cocteau movie about Oedipus. I looked at hundreds of pictures of the star of that movie that they were supposed to have copied that haircut from. And this is how it's styled. He did not have it falling forward. He did not have it over his forehead. It may have been another Jean Cocteau movie, or it may have just been the fact that, as Astrid says, and to that, happy birthday, Astrid. But she says it's all bullshit. She goes, every German boy had his hair cut like that. I did not give them anything that everybody else didn't have in Germany. Stuart had his hair like that for years. They give me this credit. It had nothing to do with me. So that was.
You have to wonder if that trip inspired Paul at all when he wrote his song "Cafe on the Left Bank" and all his.
Left Bank.
That's true.
You wonder if he was thinking back to that trip when he wrote that song at all. If he did, if he was at all, just in all the references to Paris and everything.
It has to be because that's where Jürgen's apartment or hotel. Some people say hotel. Some people say apartment was on the Left Bank. They probably walk right down. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any truth that they agreed, doing research, they agreed not to get each other anything for their birthdays? So I think from what I read, Paul just, bought him a cheeseburger and a Coke on his birthday.
Yeah. And, everybody says, and I'm sure that Motter did give John this money for his birthday, but John doesn't make a big deal of it. What he says is, my birthday happened while we were there. Like, this trip wasn't planned for my birthday. It just happened while we were there.
See, it's very interesting. John's got a wealthy aunt, but Paul didn't have those kind of resources. John's family had money. The McCartneys didn't have anything. The Lennons had money, and you could speak to that more.
Yes, they did, but Paul says, I was always in awe of John because we thought of him as upper class.
Yes.
Middle class.
And then working class.
Yeah. And then he kind of says, well, then later he wrote this song, this working class hero song. But what the point is that John is making a satirical comment on my life is crap. And if you think being who I am is good, you're totally wrong. The Beatles were thought to be working class and we were thought to be heroes. But in truth, if you want to know about my life is they hate you at home and they hit you at school and people abandon you and no one loves you. And
he's talking working class, not in terms of money, working class in terms of being like neglected and not loved. Right.
Because the next year or 2 years later, when Paul has his party, John is so jealous. He doesn't know what to do. So jealous.
Because he has all that love and attention from his family. So while the McCartneys don't have the money to do it, but they have the emotional support and everything, the stability that the Lennon family does not have for him.
Got it. You got it. They have rented a pink and white striped tent. They've got a birthday cake that's bigger than a wedding cake. That cost a bundle of money. They've got a table laden with presents, and all of the Merseyside bands are there. Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas, and they're all
performing. Shadows.
Yes, two of the Shadows are there, Matt gets up and plays, and John is getting madder and madder and madder. Mimi never gave him a birthday party. Not one, not ever.
No.
All right. So, let's start then. Paul's 21st birthday party was held at his Aunt Jean's house. And then how did you pronounce the street name again?
Well, some people say Dina's Lane.
Dina's Lane. Okay.
Justin Lane. Right. Yeah.
Okay. The Foremost perform at McCartney's request. They said that they would only take a certain amount of money, but Paul insists on paying them, but then during some research, no one knows if they got paid or not. Guests include Billy J. Kramer, The Shadows, Roger McGough, Cavern Club DJ Bob Wooler. Paul is just months in his relationship with Jane Asher.
Yep.
To your point though, this is a big, family doing.
Family. Big family thing. And that's for John, that's like radar going off. I'm in an area that I'm not comfortable in.
Yeah.
It's what he wants.
He's jealous. And he's made the mistake or the brilliant move, however you want to look at it, of going on this 12-day holiday with Brian. And it's a wonderful trip. It's a wonderful trip. They go to the whole Spanish Riviera. They go to bullfights. They go to art galleries. They go to Roman ruins. It's a great trip. But when he comes home, everyone teases him about the Spanish holiday, the Spanish honeymoon.
Everybody knows about Brian.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it wasn't a secret to, it was probably a secret to us here in the States. We didn't know any, didn't know at that point in time, but everybody there, they know.
Yeah. And it's funny because you watch how history changes over time, because when Hunter Davies writes the Beatles, He says not a word about John and Brian going on this trip. He says all of the Beatles went to Tenerife. He puts John with the others. It was hush hush because, I mean, you know, at that time, being gay was a criminal offense. You get arrested.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
So they go on this trip. They really connect. They talk. John talks about Julia. Brian talks about being gay. They go to gay bars. They get to understand who they are. And they really get to know each other and become really close friends. So much so that you're not going to find this anywhere, but you have to read between the lines. Then in September, when John takes Cynthia on honeymoon in Paris, he's there for 2 weeks. Cynthia says, my 4-day honeymoon. What happens on day 5? Brian arrives. She goes home. John and Brian stay. They are very close friends, but because of what happened after the trip to Spain, they keep it quiet. They rib him in the grapes. They make fun of him in the cavern. They are constantly on him. And by that night, he's fed up with them picking on him. He's had all he can stand. He's jealous to death of Paul, and he's drinking. And when John drinks, you can't pour.
Not eating that day really either. And then somebody decides to make bad mistake. You know, probably, you know, ribbing him, you know, a lot more than what he should. You've interviewed Bob Wooler, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
And was Bob having a few of that party too?
Bob was just getting to the party.
No.
But Bob likes to pick on people. Not in a mean way. He's just Bob. He said to me, oh, so you're the lady lionizing Lennon. He loved to do alliteration and he loved to kind of, you know.
Yeah.
So I said, Bob, what specifically did you say to John? He said, I am taking that to my grave. I am never repeating that again. He goes, but I will tell you this. It was my fault. He said, he was drunk and I knew better. You watch the story. It's like that game that you play where you whisper in someone's ear and then they whisper in someone's ear.
Telephone.
Yeah.
That's it. Because at first it's that John beat him up. He had bruised ribs. He had to get a few stitches. That was the first story. Second story gets to be, oh, he has a broken collarbone. Then by the time we get to the 1980s and 1990s, John picks up a shovel and hits him with it.
Right.
It just grew. It grew legs, right?
Yeah. He was beat up. There's no doubt about it. But there were no hard feelings. That when the Beatles play this episode, this shirt that I have on, which is the last night at the Cavern Club, August 3rd, 1963, Bob avoids him. He stays out in the band area and John is back in the dressing room and they don't really talk. But by the time they get to the Northern premiere of A Hard Day's Night in Liverpool, Bob is invited to the town hall, to the reception. He and John shake hands. They talk to one another and they get along just fine. They're over it. But people act like, you know, he beat him to a pulp. I'm sure he smashed him.
Right. I mean, understand. I mean, when you're young, you know, not everybody's secure, right, in their masculinity.
Right.
And then who's to say if Brian and John did have some kind of romance? Who's to know? But that's not the only incident, though, that happens that night as well. I mean, then there's the story with Billy J. Kramer's girlfriend as well, which is an unfortunate happening. You know, with him insulting his girlfriend.
Yeah. Well, he grabbed her breast. It was pretty bad. It was not a good thing. But the scary part for me is this. We, you know, just released the audiobook of She Loves You, which begins with the trip to Spain. And then Paul's birthday is right just a little bit into it. And people, I had this lady, one lady write on Amazon one time, I want a biography written about John by someone who loves John, not someone who criticizes him. Okay, well, I'm not criticizing him. This is what happened. This is what he did. And it wasn't good. There are a lot of good things that he did. That night was a bad night. He said to Pete Shotten, let's swap wives, you know? Yeah. And Pete's like, you're going home. You have had too much to drink. You're
right.
Home, you know, It was not a good night for John. And I don't want people to get into the beginning of the book and go, oh no, she hates John.
No.
I don't.
No, of course
you
not.
You have to look at both sides of the coin, right? Yeah. I mean, we just had the Alan Cozen and Adrian Sinclair on for their, you know, McCartney Legacy book. And, you know, and they don't pull any punches either. Look, if one of the band members said something bad in a article or an interview, they put it in the book.
Yeah. You have to let the facts, right, good or bad, show for history to people know what went on.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand why he was so upset, but you still don't act like that. And Cynthia was so excited because she was getting to go out with him for, you know, because she never got to go anywhere with him. And she had gotten a new dress and she was all thrilled, and it ended up being a bad night. So I see
it was taking off at that point. So I can understand her being excited about, you know, wanting to go out with her husband.
Right. Exactly right. And she is, I mean, the book is dedicated to her, and a lot of it is her story, because this is June, and by the end of August, she is just, for the first time, getting to go somewhere with John. Brian decides, he starts thinking about it, and he thinks, if people find out that John's married and I've shunted her away and haven't talked about her and kept her in hiding, they are going to think I'm a terrible person. So I need to let her come. So he lets her go to Bournemouth with John when they go down for that week that they're in Bournemouth, and she gets to go.
It still seems like they was still, like, people knew, but they didn't broadcast that he was married.
Right.
You know,
press knew, which is so funny because I've just been watching the Harry and Meghan story, that whole series. What a difference, because the press were protecting the Beatles. They would say things like, can we talk about your wife now?
Right. Totally opposite now.
Yeah.
Right. Well, talking about the press, now the incident does make the Daily Mirror. Did you happen to find that article?
Yes. Yes, I did. And it was manufactured. It was totally written by Tony Barrow.
It was in the Daily Mirror or the Echo?
The Mirror picked it up. It was in the Mirror. Tony Barrow wrote the article for the Echo.
Oh, he did? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's picked up, but Tony just, you know, has John apologizing all over the place. The story of John's life, to me, is apologizing. How many times in a song does he say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I hurt you. I'll be a good boy. I'm sorry. Then, you know, you have the whole date book thing where what he says is taken out of context. And I don't know if you've ever seen Chuck Gunderson's portrayal of that, when he shows the 1966 North American tour, and everywhere John goes, he has to apologize. The first time he's apologizing, he's crying. And the next time he's teared up. And by the time he's done it, the last time he's like, all right, I'm sorry, okay? You know, the man spent his life apologizing.
Yeah, he did.
Mm-hmm. It really came through a lot for him, you know, during that time too. You know, trying to take some of the heat off. You know, I remember seeing an interview with Paul during that, and someone talking about, oh, how's this tour going to go because of the incident? And Paul said, oh, it's going to be a laugh. You know, trying to take the attention away from John. So I always thought that was really cool of, you know, John, you know, trying to, you know, take some of the, you know, pressure off off of his friend.
And that part of the story never gets told. We always talk about, well, what did John say to Paul? When other people would come at them, man, the bond that they had, it was like, you can say that to him. You know, I can say that to him. Right. You can't. Right. You better not. And there was so much of that.
Yeah. George Martin says in All You Need Is Ears, they could form a wall and they could turn on you at any given moment. If you attacked one of them, the others would rally.
Right.
And you didn't do that's family. You know,
right. It's family. So an incident like at Paul's birthday, in the moment, it's a horrible night. But because they went through that together as friends, those are things that, like, it doesn't have to be spoken about. It's like, you know, Paul was always there for him, you know, even though, you know, despite everything happening and Lennon and it's in the Daily Mirror, you know, they're at the end of the day, that bond is still intact.
Yeah, and they relied on Paul always to make things right.
Always to be the PR man.
Yeah, the Scotland tour, when they hit those two little ladies at a stop sign. I mean, they rear-ended two little old ladies at a stop sign.
Is it the Johnny Gentle tour?
Yes. Yeah. And so they send Paul up there. They go, send Paul.
He'll of course. Paul was also the one that probably told, well, no, when it came to sack. But they didn't have enough when they had to sack Pete, though. They made Brian do it.
Yeah, well, nobody wanted to bell that cat. I mean, nobody wanted to be a part.
Not even Paul could do that one.
But then 1965, that San Francisco night, if people watch the videos, there are two on YouTube, one of the matinee and one of the evening performance, it's horrendous. They're throwing folding chairs. They're jumping off of the divider that they built behind them onto the stage. It is the most horrific thing I've ever seen. And what do? They go get Paul. Paul, go talk to them. And he tries. He says, you know, please sit down. Please stop throwing things. Please behave. Things are getting dangerous. But nobody listens. I mean, you know, he's always the one sent out to try to make it right. Always.
It's true.
Yeah. He's the PR guy.
Yeah.
He knows what to say and he knows how to say it. If you can talk your way out of hitting two ladies at a stop sign, you could do it.
And even, yeah, and so John knew that, and John was jealous of it, even going out with the release of McCartney. He said, John Paul's a good PR man. I wish I did that for my album.
Yeah. Yeah.
even at the end.
Yeah. You know, and it's just too bad that they did not go on that trip to New Orleans and get back together and really, it's
I tell you what though, Jude, have you seen that interview with John, with Robert Hilburn? It's on YouTube. It's really dark quality. It's hard to see, but you can hear it. And did you hear Coming Up or whatever? But we know we heard Coming Up, and he goes, were you surprised by that? And John just says, would you be surprised by, by your brother from age 15?
Right.
Says that to him.
Was there one of Paul's songs that you came in with that you thought was like you were surprised they could write something that well good or
did? No, he never surprised me because it was like you can be surprised by your brother from age 15 on. Not surprised, but I think.
Yeah, I don't think there was any enmity between them. I think their feelings had all been healed and everything was good. But I wish that they had some time together to hang out for a few days, and you know, who knows what would have happened.
Right. But just even at that moment, just a couple of weeks left of his life, he's saying that your brother since age 15, and that goes largely unnoticed because it's not really a well-known interview, but I'll send it your way.
Yeah. I would love to see that. Love to see that. And I think that's what really hurt John about George, not including him in his biography, because he sees them as brothers. I mean, really brothers, not just, you know, oh, you're my bro, you know, no brother, you're my brother. And he was really hurt by it, but he has tender feelings. I would say of all of the Beatles, John probably got his feelings hurt the most because he was so insecure.
Yeah. And wore his heart on his sleeve.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. Yep. Right. Anything that, like, for example, they're waiting to go out on one of the one of the gigs on the 1965 tour, and a girl walking down the hallway pokes her head in the door and yells, John Lennon. And he turns around and looks, and she goes, you're an asshole, and keeps walking. He's like, what did that girl just say to me? And they're all laughing about it. And he goes, why would she say that? What did she do? And he's all upset about it. They're like, they're falling out of their chairs laughing, you know? Right. He just, anything anyone said, he could not let it go. He just.
Well, he really made an effort there to please his fans if they came up to wanting an autograph, especially those New York years. I mean, you know, people would come up to him all the time, autograph, always willing to please, except for when he's eating, you know, he wants to eat in peace. Yeah. You know, let me eat. And afterwards, you know, fine. But, you know, remarkable individual.
Yeah, Jay Bergen says that. I don't know if y'all have read.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, I did. What a great book.
Oh, a great, and obviously changed my life because I heard it on the audiobook, and the guy that does John Lennon, I don't know if y'all have heard the audiobook.
Not the audiobook.
Yeah. But, oh, I was like, okay, this guy, isn't someone doing John Lennon? this is John Lennon.
It was so refreshing because it was all new information. It was a period of John's life that has not been written about. That was like, oh my God, John in court, you know, talking about the tapes and what they sound like. And that was incredible.
It was incredible. How do I order my songs on an album? What is my reasoning for putting them in an order? What is my creative process? It's all
that.
All new stuff. But Jay talks very much about how John was kind to the fans and that they would be walking down the street in New York and he would see someone coming and he would say, you're going to have to excuse me. I can tell you that this person wants to speak to me. one of John's longtime fans, Patty Noah, who passed away a couple of years ago, said she was a teenager and she was walking in New York City and John and Yoko were walking toward her and she didn't want to interrupt him or do anything. So she just she made eye contact with him and then she walked by. And when she did, he reached out and squeezed her hand.
Wow.
Let me ask you, you know, as you're writing these books, you know, do you look at it as a positive or a negative when you see other people also releasing John Lennon books? Because you want to be the person that, you know, tells the actual story. You want to be as factual as possible. But then yet here's all these other people also releasing.
John Lennon. Yay. Thank you very much. Keep writing because
less work for me.
Everything you dig up, I am going to inculcate into the work. Everything when Ken Womack wrote John Lennon 1980, I did a happy dance all the way down the street because all that stuff that he uncovered, I mean, great material. He wrote it so well and he researched it so well. Right. Thank you, Ken.
Let me ask you another question, Kit. I'm sorry, Kit. I'm thinking about the fest.
I'd be honored to be Kit.
In 2023, Jude, do you feel that John Lennon is marginalized?
I think that it's trending that way. And I don't say this just lightly. I say I've been doing research. And I've been, every time that I'm in the car for several hours, I listen to SiriusXM. And I keep a tally of how many songs per hour each Beatle gets. And look, Paul has lived twice as long as John lived, and he had a great solo career. So it would be weird if he didn't get more playtime than John because he's had a longer career. There's no doubt. But the record right now is coming in. Like, I think the last time I did it, it was Paul, 5 or 6 songs, John 2, George 2, Ringo 1. We got to swing it back to a little bit more of a balance.
Well, see, are you talking about Tom? Talking about the Sirius channel, the Sirius XM Beatles channel?
Yeah.
Now, just to comment on that, I think they need to play a little more solo Beatles anyway. I'd like to turn that on and hear, you know, One Day at a Time or Meat City or something from Walls and Bridges. And you're not hearing that as much. So if they had played a little more solo stuff, that ratio that you're talking about would be a little better. Let me hear Remember. Let me hear God. Let me hear Crippled Inside. Let me hear, and they don't do that.
That's something that we can do. I mean, we as people listening to that stuff, we can send emails. We can say, hey, look, you know, this, you know, the John to Paul stuff. I mean, it's not fair. We need more, you know, you should be playing more John.
Yeah.
You know, and if they, you know, we need to swing the pendulum both ways. I mean, it just can't you know, be on one side.
And we can't portray John just as a peacenik, like in yesterday. Right. And I know that was an alternative John, but like John was the bad boy of rock and roll. He would freak out if he thought he was being thought of as Namsy Pamsy. He wanted you to know he was a leather
rocker, which is right. Which is, for my money, my favorite John Lennon album is Rock and Roll because that's who he is.
Yes.
I love Plastic Ono Band and all those other, but Rock and roll, that's who he is, man. And I think to your point, it's like you ask younger people now, they just know him as the peacenik and give peace a chance and imagine. And we all know, he's so much more than that.
Right. And there's no way that you can survive everything he survived without being tough. He's tough. You know, I mean, he has a good heart, but he doesn't want to be remembered as some sweet old dude.
No.
You know, so I just, you know, I think that things... History is slippery. That's what Morgan Llewellyn said. And it is. Just look at how many things that we discovered just in the John and Paul trip to Paris that they didn't Miss Bookings. That came out in Pete's book, Beetle, that he did with Don Caster. But right. It was true, and Mark Lewison's proved it, and Bill Harry, that it probably wasn't 100 pounds. It felt like 100 pounds. Paul's the one that says right. It's 100 pounds in the anthology. I bet it felt like that to him, but it was only 40 pounds. There's so much that gets changed over history, and we need to bring yep. the right. back to what it was.
Right. A couple other questions. What did you think about biographies of John before you started writing these books? I mean, what are some of your favorites? I mean, what do you think are some of the more accurate ones? What do you think the ones that are more bullshit? I mean, what do you think about some of these books?
Well, you can't go wrong with Ray Coleman's Lemon. I mean, he was okay. close friends with him. He knew him. They had many conversations together. What I don't like about Ray Coleman's book was the way he organized it. There's childhood, teen years, then there's music, Hamburg, art school. Events aren't chronological, so it's hard to find what you want. Thank goodness he did an index, because it's not chronological. But he captured the heart of John. He did a great job with that book. It's really good. I mean, Philip Norman's John Lennon, The Life is an accurate portrayal. There are things in there that I did not include in my book because I don't see a need to include Patricia Ender. Some of the darker, nasty stuff I didn't include, but I know they happened, and he says they happened, and it's a good portrayal. Shout is more balanced of all four Beatles. Right. I want to say that Bob Spitz has been really ridden out of town on the rails because he's got mistakes in his book.
Oh. He does.
He's got mistakes in their book. We try not to. We try really hard. But he has some good material in there, too, that he found some good things. And Albert Goldman could see the sky. And instead of it being a pale evening gray, it was rat gray. It was his way of looking at things. His facts are right.
Correct. And one of the things we learned when we were in Liverpool, because we actually met his Liverpool researcher who came to speak to us.
Yeah.
Goldman's whole, his bias is there clearly, but his methods and his research was spot on.
Yes. He's the first person to dig out the fact that social services had been to see Julia twice and that they had warned her they were going to take John away from her. And
right. So we know his agenda. He's got his agenda. That's clear. But his research, especially in the early days, was correct.
Spot on. So I think there's good in every book. You'll find some facts that you won't find somewhere else. And I think Bill Harry has ever been overlooked as a source, because people say, oh, well, he's old. Well, he's primary source. He was there. Mm-hmm. And he's got a great memory, sharp as can be.
Talking about this,
that's the one.
Right? Yes. Yeah. It's a great, great resource. And he is still as sharp as a tack.
And he's one of the very few remaining people that could tell you about those days. That's not actually Paul or Ringo. That is, everybody else sadly is gone.
And mostly. Ivor Davis's book, The Beatles and Me on Tour, 64, 65, brilliant book. He is the one that said to me, yes, the Beatles smoked pot with Dylan, but they did not do it in downtown New York City in the Delmonico. There were 200 police there that night. Brian wasn't crazy. It was a few days later at the Riverside Hotel, the last night of the tour, when if they were caught smoking pot, it wouldn't have blown the whole tour to pieces. Dylan arrived with a rucksack on. They go into the room. He goes, this is what happened. Trust me. I grilled him on it. He said they did smoke pot with him. It was they just have it at the wrong hotel. It was a couple of days later, and it was at the other hotel, because Brian was cagey. He wasn't about to get his band the tour stopped.
Right. Also, are you happy with the amount of material that's been coming out about John these last 10 years? I mean, we're getting, Funko Pop figures. We're getting, box sets of the albums. We're getting, great books like Chip Mattinger's book and, Ken Womack's book. Yeah. I mean, for me, the last, you know, 10 years or whatever, he's been more visible than ever for, I mean, in my lifespan anyway.
Right. Right. That's true. I hadn't thought about that. That's a really good point. They, I mean, just John Lennon 1980 alone was a landmark work. Yeah. So, you know, maybe I'm being too harsh. I just, when I'm listening on the radio and it keeps not being a John song, I'm like, what? Yeah, come on. So maybe I'm being too picky, Tom.
Well, I get it. I understand. And I want, you know, because I'm still a Beatle John guy. Okay, now Paul might be my favorite solo artist, but when it comes to the Beatles, I am still all about John and his music. And I think, you know, shame on those DJs if they're not doing equal time, even if it's a request show, the DJ should be making John's music more.
I mean, we've got the George Harrison Dark Horse Hour with Laura Cantrell, right? Well, why can't we have the Plastic Ono Band Hour and hear an hour of solo John music?
Right. I mean, listen, some of my in fact, Al was just on your show recently, and I told him about 2 years ago, I said, you know, Al, I really like John's solo career. That's my favorite. He walked away and he came back. About 30 minutes later, I got a bone to pick with you. And I said, okay, go ahead. And he goes, did you just say you prefer John's solo music? And I said, I did. He goes, give me some examples.
Angel Baby.
And so I did. And he's like, okay, all right, but I don't like it. I love Sometime in New York City.
There you go. I mean, there's you know, controversy right there. I mean, do you think the controversy of the song is what's holding back a release of a recent box set?
Probably.
Like we got for Imagine and Plastic Ono Band?
Probably. And so many people think that it's trash, but it was a woke album before there was such a thing as woke. I mean,
correct.
It's about prisoners' rights and women's rights.
A record very much of from the era from which it came.
Yeah, it is. And so many of the songs are earworms. If you hear Attica State, don't even make me think about it. You'll be thinking about it for the rest of the night. You can't get it out of your head. So many of them are great songs. Angela is a beautiful song. You may not love the way Yoko sings, but it is a beautiful song. And Sunday Bloody Sunday, it doesn't get any better than Sunday Bloody Sunday. So
I like that one. I like that one. Not a lot of people like that one, but I do.
No, but and then New York City, just a flat out rocker.
Which I think they should have released that as the single. I don't think they should have released
I know. So, and it's so funny that we can't say it, and you can't request that song on Alexa, who's listening to me, because you can't say that word, and yet I don't know if you listen to current music. I'm a big fan of all his.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, okay, is it John? Is it?
It's one? Every other word. It's every other word. So for like 20 years now. It's used in hip hop for 20 years longer.
Longer.
So why can't John Lennon say it?
Right.
And you know, especially since he went to the NAACP and he asked, "Is this okay?"
And they were okay with it.
They endorsed him.
Right.
The caucus in Congress endorsed him and said he is making a powerful statement here.
Statement.
And we get
if that was to come out and like the Lennon camp was going to say, look, and just contextualize it and say, look, this is from the period it's made. It's not what you think it is.
Right.
Listen to it.
Yes.
People don't do that anymore. People are lazy. They're just going to hear the song and say, oh my God. You know, they're not.
Well, that's most of America for you. I hate to say it, but us Yanks don't get it right.
Yeah. So, you know, I really don't understand it. And he loved it so much and felt that it was so important that instead of making New York City the opening song, which he should have done, that's the kicker. That's the one that draws you into the LP. He puts that first because to him, that's the most important thing.
But he did kind of walk it back before the end of his life. He was like, oh, we shouldn't have done that record. You know that there's that sound of him saying we shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, well, because he got in trouble about it. Once again, people were like, it's no good, you know.
Drew, let's go back to the books. You got Kindle versions now, right, for just about every volume?
Every volume.
Or everyone. Yeah. Everyone, okay.
Yeah. So, and,
talk about
they're on all ebook formats, except for the first book's only on Kindle, but after that they're on every ebook format, Nook and Libre or whatever you use. It's on every one. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I'm so excited about is this audiobook, because I'm telling you guys, Scott R. McKinley, the guy that did the audiobook, like I said, he did Jay Bergen's book, and that's where I found him, and he was so good. So I said to him, can you do Paul? He said, I do Paul better than I do John. I said, what about George? Wow. George is my wheelhouse. I said, what about Ringo? He said, well, I'm not as good at Ringo, but I'll learn him. He had to learn 180 voices for this book. 180. Wow. Cynthia, Mimi, Sid Bernstein, Ed Sullivan, Trini Lopez, Roy Orbison, Bobby Goldsboro, Neil, Mal, Tony Barrow, you name it. He studied and studied and studied and learned all their voices. And I was scared to death about Cynthia because he's a guy. And I thought, how's he going to do Cynthia's voice? I was really worried. He even got, she has a little lisp that she does. And he even got her little lisp. It's incredible. It's the third one. It's She Loves You.
Yeah. She loves you.
Right. Yeah. Which, by the way, I mean, there's no more physical copies of that. I mean, you got to go to eBay. You got to find that. Matter of fact, the only book you have left available in physical copyright is the fifth book here.
I have some of volume four, not many. And okay. I've got volume five.
Where do people find these books?
Everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, TheFast.com, and John Lennon Series is my website, johnlennonseries.com. Oh, that's a real collector's item.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking before we recorded, like, the first book.
2010.
Talking before we started recording about the first book having with the CD.
Yes.
In the back, which is a collector's item now.
Second printing does. It has that interview with Alan Williams in it. When we did Should Have Been There, we reprinted Should Have Been There five times. And we try to do something different in every printing. So the first one is a first edition. The second one had the CD. For each one, we did a different cover for the third one. And for the last one, we got Shannon to do a picture of John that she did not sell. She still has the original. And when Chaz Newby saw it, I have his copy that he wrote on the cover. That is the John I knew, because he has the Elvis curl. Yeah. In the front
Andy, you got the book right there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one. Yeah.
Shannon, beautiful work.
All right. Oh, yeah.
So
I just got the second one. I've got two of the same, but I like the other cover. So I got the other one.
Yeah.
So the question is, I mean, you plan on making this as a 9-volume set? Is that my understanding?
It's actually going to be 10 because book five has two parts. It just got too heavy and it was too long. And they were just leaving on the 1965 North American tour where they're going to do Shea Stadium and they're going to meet Elvis. Elvis took 3 months to research and another 2 months to write, 5 months on one chapter. Wow. But I sent Mark Lewis and I wrote to him and said, are you up to Elvis yet? And he said, not yet. What do you have? And I said, I've got 75 type pages of notes. Why don't reinvent the wheel? Let me just send this. And I'm sure he'll do his own research. But when somebody's done 75 pages of notes, you might as well just take it. So I sent it to him and he wrote back and said, I don't know whether to laugh or to cry at the discrepancies. People disagree about everything. If you can think of one thing at Elvis's house, what he had on, what was on the jukebox, did they jam, what songs did they play, where was Ringo, where was George, they argue about everything. That was so hard to write. So hard.
Interesting. I mean, it's hard to believe. I mean, we're like 65 right now and it's 15 more years he's with us. It's just really remarkable. Shades of Life, Volume 5. When will we, Part 1, when do you think we'll get Part 2 of Shades of Life?
October of 2024. So I have 18 months and I'm sweating bullets because it took 8 months to do the audiobook. Really hard work. because I read the notes at the end of every chapter. And then every night we would get the recordings and we'd listen to them and vet them and make changes and tweak and drop in music. And so I got behind. So now I'm totally working like a dog to try to catch
up. All right. No more shows. Get to writing.
You'll be at the fest in Chicago.
I will be there. I can't wait to see y'all.
So I'll be there.
Right. Now, is every book going to have start with an S word?
Yes. Some of them don't have SH.
Right.
The next one after this one is She Said, She Said. So it stays with it. And Shine On is the last book.
Nice.
Well, let's just wrap it up by plugging anything you want. She Said, She Said is a wonderful show you do with your friend. Talk about that real quick.
Lena Sag and I have been doing that podcast for the last 6 years, and we are really at a point where we may call it quits because we've gotten to talk to everyone that we wanted to have on. We got to have Chaz Newby, Rogue Best, Julia Baird, Helen Anderson. We would still love to have May Pang and talk to May and Pete. I haven't talked to Pete in about 4 or 5 years. I had him on the John Lennon Hour when I used to do that show on Beatles-O-Rama, but Lena and I haven't. And so we're maybe do a few more, but Lena bought not one, but two gyms in Evansville, Indiana. And she runs those two gyms and she's so busy. She doesn't even know what her name is. She's the only employee. She's the front desk person and the weight trainer and you name it. So we're kind of taking that one day at a time, but my main focus has been because the reason we decided to start with this book is the first audio book is because it's the height of action. You're in 1963. They do the Royal Command performance and the Sunday night at the London Palladium and then they go to Paris and perform there. And then find out they're number one in America and then come and do Ed Sullivan. That's all in that book. But we're going to move right on to book four, right on to book five, and then come back and do one and two. So I'm trying to juggle that along with writing these.
So many books and so little time, right?
The honest truth. It is the honest truth.
Wow.
I write the Fest blog, and we've been researching Rubber Soul, and now we're into Revolver, and I spend like 10 hours a month working on that. So we need more hours. Could y'all get some more hours?
It'd be nice.
We'll see what we can do about that. But you, thank you very, very much for coming on and talking about two interesting, parts of Beatle history, the 21st birthdays of John and Paul. Really appreciate you coming on here. Real quick, Andy, anything going on with your other leg show?
No, that one's pretty quiet, but I'm all confirmed for the fest in August, and I'm really happy about it. So I'll be at the Chicago Fest for my second Chicago Fest, when details to emerge on panels and whatnot in the coming months. So stay tuned.
Very cool.
That is great. We can't wait to see you. Yeah.
Oh, me either. Yeah,
so Two Legs, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Two Legs Podcast. Please check out our YouTube channel, which you're probably watching right now. If you haven't, please subscribe. We're trying to get to that 2K subscriber goal, and we're getting closer. We're at 1.47 right now, and we'd really like your help to help us get to that 2K goal. And like I said, we'll have a contest afterwards. I'll probably end up just getting an Amazon gift card or whatever and just like dish out, we'll just dish out, make it rain Amazon gift cards, right?
That's it.
But anyways, email us at twolegspodcast@gmail.com. If you have an idea for a show, we'd love to hear it. We take people's ideas from time to time, but we don't have any shortage of ideas here. I mean, 6 years strong and we're still plugging away.
Once a week, baby.
Yeah. So Andy, thank you very much. Jude, dear, it was great to see you again. We love you. Can't wait to see you again. I'm Tom Hunyadi, Andy, Jude. As always, have a great day and a beautiful night. Take care, everyone.
You've been listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan C.